Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So, in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, I'm sure you saw there was lots of politicians across the EU calling for similar votes in their country. That's what I wanted to discuss today. What I mean, which country for you is the one where we're most likely to see another referendum on leaving the EU?
Well, I think if there are two countries that actually stand out for me, I think they are probably France and Denmark, but for very different reasons. Denmark, I think, has a situation where it's got a long history of relatively critical positions on integration. Where you've got Eurosceptics who have a strong position within the Folketing, the Danish Parliament, and I think you might see that, particularly after the limiting of free movements on through Schengen that took place last summer, that there might be some enthusiasm for trying to push for a referendum, not least also because the Danish economy is relatively closely aligned with the British economy. So, if the UK steps out of the EU, that reduces some of the economic cost. But I think probably the country where we're going to see the biggest push is going to be France, because we've got Marine Le Pen, who's looking very well placed for the elections in the spring next year. She's at the moment, she looks like she's going to get through to the second round. So I think she's certainly pushing for a referendum. What you also might see, though, is that her opponents might decide that they need to try and close that issue down and might try and match her offer and say, yes, we'll do a referendum. We'll offer a referendum on membership, because that's going to be a way of sort of closing down that issue and or delaying it, so that whoever actually wins the presidential election, we might still end up with having that vote.
Yeah, we saw, I think, in the last regional elections in France, the Front National, the Democrats and the UMP teaming up together to keep Le Pen out.
Yeah. But I think, that kind of is a reflection of the limitations of that approach, that it kind of reinforces the message that the parties like the FN have been making, which is that they are not the establishment, that, whether it's left or right, these people are actually just the same. It's all part of the same elite. And so it's time to kick these people out. So I think that's a very different, I think you've seen that effort to try and put a cordon sanitaire around populists and far right parties, but not with great success. And if you look at the two main parties in France, neither of them look in great condition. I think Hollande has been a very big disappointment for the left. He's not really been strengthened at all. He's not been able to build on his reputation in the wake of the various terrorist attacks. And when the most credible opponent to Le Pen looks like it might be Nicolas Sarkozy coming back and re-energizing things on the center right, that doesn't look like new politics. That looks like the establishment trying to defend itself. And as much as Sarkozy's he's a credible and formidable political operative, he is, we've been round this one before. And people might say, well, Sarkozy was all a bit much last time round. Do we really want to do that again? And I think Hollande has not making life easier by saying that he wants, looking like he wants to stay in the race. He would probably have done better just to step back and say that he's going to let somebody else from the left pick up the mantle.
Okay. So, you said that we might see a situation where the traditional parties offer a referendum to keep Le Pen out. What, for you, is the likelihood of the French voting to leave the EU?
I think it's going to be like the UK in a considerable extent. It's going to be very close, and I think there's long been discontent in France. You saw that already 25 years ago with the Maastricht, the little yes for Maastricht, which was 52% yes, or 51% even. You saw it in the voting down of the Constitutional Treaty in 2005. You have to imagine that whilst it might be different because it's about membership rather than about a treaty, that that gives more of an advantage to the current situation. I think, given the state of French politics, given the state of the EU, a lot of voters might just say, well, I'm just sick and tired of it, and yes, it might not be the best thing, but I'm prepared to try moving
Continue.
out, try see how bad this thing might be, because already things feel pretty awful. So I think at best it would be a very close race, and it might well be that just if the UK doesn't look like it's completely fallen apart, that then they might say, well, okay, we can take the hit and we can move to a new situation where we're in a happier place.
That's going to be key, isn't it? What happens in the UK for the rest of Europe
Yeah, and I
and
think that
Euroscepticism?
that and clearly that's a key part of the Article 50 negotiations when we ever get to them, that the other member states don't have an interest in having giving a good deal to the UK. The problem's going to be that as you've seen in the weeks since the referendum, the majorities for either having a referendum or for wanting to leave the EU have fallen across the EU27 as they've seen the short-term problems. But at some point, the UK is not going to fall apart as a country, economically, politically. That it's not the end of the world for it. So at some point, it will pick up again or be able to create a narrative of, well, we're fine. And at that point, whether that's in a year or in 5 years' time, at that point, somebody somewhere will say, well, that's because the UK left the EU. It doesn't need the EU to succeed. And then there are going to be these calls. So even if we don't have a referendum come out of the French presidential election next year, you have to imagine that over the next 5 to 10 years, there will be a lot more pressure on other countries to go down this path, particularly if the UK looks like it's doing reasonably well.
Okay. What can we just go back to Denmark quickly? You
Yeah,
mentioned that was
there's
also a
probably, well,
light
can I just finish
candidate.
on, there's one other point on France, which
Yeah,
is
sure.
that there is a massive additional complication with France. Well, there are two. One is the euro, that any country that has the euro as a single currency, leaving the EU, there's a whole question about managing the currency issue, because to leave the single currency is atrociously difficult. But, it makes the kind of the Greek situation look like a tea party. So I think, that's going to be a big limiter of any Eurozone country leaving. The other issue clearly is that if France leaves the EU, the EU has a fundamental problem of what it's for. It loses a core member state. So it's going to create a lot more impact across the EU, but that's going to be a longer run issue. But yes, Denmark.
Yeah, sorry, just on France quickly. I think the whole currency thing also is something the Front National are using to rally the troops. They're sort of saying, "Oh, let's have the franc back. Let's go back to the good times."
Yeah, and you can make that argument, because also it's a classic bit of anti-establishment politics, precisely because you're not going to be able to move back to the franc in any sensible kind of way. So it can always be the thing that it's the greener grass that you can never get to, because to get to it is such a massively difficult process. Really, the only way it can happen is that you have a general collapse of the Eurozone, and by extension, a collapse of the European Union. So, yeah, it's of course the FN is going to make a lot of returning to the franc, because they will probably never have to pony up to that reality. It can always be something they can paint in wonderful terms.
Okay, let's get on to Denmark then. You said it was one of the most likely. The Eurobarometer survey would suggest otherwise. It's, I think, 23% negative view of the EU. Do you think it's, why do you think it's so likely?
I think it's in relative terms, it's more likely, because I think it's always been a country that sort of sat somewhere on the edge of the system, in terms of its opt-outs, that has the fact that it's probably never going to join the euro. I think it's always taken a somewhat ambivalent position. The difference in the Danish debate is that withdrawing has never really been a substantial part of the debate. It's really only in the UK that withdrawal has been a big part of what's discussed about European integration as an option. I think what's still a bit too early to say is how much Danish People's Party in particular are going to try and capitalize on this situation. I think you have seen a certain turning in of Danish politics in recent years, that it's not as open and as friendly as it has been. And I think that that there's the preconditions for a much more negative turn as we go along. And again, I think it's going to be a reflection of how Danish coalitions can hang together as they go along.
Because the Danish People's Party, the Eurosceptics, hold the balance of power, don't they? So they're.
They do, and again, over time they have become more and more influential. And again, you used to see this kind of effort to hold them out of any position of power. Now you're sort of bringing them in this balancing role. I'm still not sure that the Danes have really reached a stable position in the changes in their party system. So I think There's clearly a lot of potential, but yeah, it might well be that it doesn't actually come to anything, that it might be a decision that certainly without the UK being clear about what they are trying to do, and I think that's a big problem, that the Danes might think that it's not worth trying to push on that particular front
And
in terms
as I
of.
understand it, the Danish People's Party wants a referendum on the conditions of EU membership rather than leaving the EU. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what they're asking
Okay.
for. Again, there's a question about whether, again, we're kind of going down the sort of David Cameron route of trying to renegotiate terms, which potentially, are they seriously trying to do it to change the terms of membership, or is it in effect a way of getting to withdrawal by demanding things that are not going to happen?
Okay.
So I think that's the big unanswered part of what's going on. And I think, if they've learnt anything, that probably what they've learnt from the British case is that actually, trying to not go down the road of going for straight with withdrawal, but trying to do it through a referendum device and saying giving people a voice and a vote about how things are is probably a more successful, has more chances of success
Yeah.
as a way of achieving your ultimate objectives.
Okay. Let's move on to a few more countries if you've finished with Denmark. I was expecting you to mention the Netherlands. There's a general election next March, I think,
Yeah.
and the Eurosceptics are leading in the opinion polls, or they were.
Yeah, I think the Netherlands is again in a it's one of these kind of strange positions that it is so deeply, it's deeply and profoundly integrated into the European economy. Its position as a entry point through Rotterdam for the whole of the Rhineland means that it has to have open trading relations. That if it has any kind of restrictions on trade with its neighbours, that is economically disastrous. The difficulty for someone like Wilders is he probably knows that. So he does know that. So how much does he try and work within the EU system to limit free movement, rather than just saying we try and leave altogether? So I think that's one of their big challenges, is that the degree of integration it is much higher into the Eurozone, very clearly. And I think, yes, the PVV is going to be a big force, but I think there isn't. I don't get the sense that other parties are willing to indulge Wilders any more than they already have.
Okay.
It doesn't feel like the same kind of dynamics, for example, as in France, where there seems to be a sort of a bankruptcy of ideas about what to do. And so it's all working around the FN. I think in the Dutch case, I think the other parties do look a bit more able to try and find alternative strategies, and I think they can draw on a much stronger liberal cosmopolitan
Okay.
tradition,
Fine.
which I think limits the potential for that. And Wilders is not he's not actually pushed as hard as he could have done, I think, on the referendum front and on the membership front. I think he's carried on with his kind of previous positions, but he's not tried to make huge capital out of it in a way that looks very obvious.
Okay. Maybe that's a strategy.
Maybe it is.
Yeah. Okay. What about Italy? There's a constitutional referendum coming up. Renzi
Yeah.
said he's going to resign if he loses. And the Eurosceptic five-star movement are on the rise in city elections, city mayoral elections. Is there any
Well,
potential
I'm
there, do you think?
yeah, there's potential, but again, that's going to be there's a multi-step issue that Renzi, this referendum again looks a bit, careless on his, well, it's very careless on his part. It's easy to see him losing this referendum, and to stake his premiership on it looks misguided. I think what he's got to work out is how much he sticks to that and whether there's a fallback position. What's he do? Does he try and push it to early elections? Does he try and find a new coalition within his existing party just to get a new leader to come in? Five Star Movement, I think, is clearly a big challenger. That I think there are still big question marks over its coherence and its stability. That Griot is not in control of the party, and in terms of what the party wants, I'm not entirely sure the party knows what it wants. It's been very successful in being sort of opportunistic in picking up on various issues. You've seen that with just the success in the mayoral elections and the rest. But I think in terms of a coherent government strategy, I'm not so sure. And again, remember that Five Star is very much grounded in popular participation, asking members for what they think. So they might say we think membership is bad or we should have a referendum, but I think there's going to be a degree of ambivalence because Italy doesn't have good alternatives. It doesn't have the same kind of it can't make the same kind of narratives that the UK can about sort of global roles and a big economy. If you have a collapse of the Renzi government, that's also going to put a lot of pressure back on the banking sector. And even though we got through the stress tests the other week, you wouldn't want to put more money into an Italian bank than you really had to. So I think the economic dangers, I think, look so significant that I think that's going to put a big break on that. And you might end up with something that looks a lot like sort of a Greek situation where everyone knows that it's a bit rubbish and that you're taking a lot of pain, but actually the alternatives look a whole lot worse. So it's not a good position to be in the longer run, but it's a very powerful incentive to say, well, actually, it's not worth pushing down this avenue of policy.
So basically, when there's financial instability like there is in Greece, Euroscepticism takes a bit of a back seat. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I think the Greek situation was a very particular one. The collapse of the Greek economy and the banking sector, the need for massive intervention, raised questions about membership. But Greece has no, there's no appetite for taking a path alone. So I think Italy is different. It's a bigger economy, but economically it looks as though it's not in a very strong position. But the credibility of it as a autonomous economic unit, I think, raises questions for Eurosceptics about how much they can create a narrative that if we leave, we can be free to, well, take control, to use the British phrase. That's a much harder sell in an Italian context. And actually, staying in the Eurozone, particularly if you're pushing towards stronger banking union, towards stronger governance, that then actually that ultimately helps the Italian economy a lot more than stepping out of the system. And again, a Eurozone member, the costs of moving out of the Eurozone are going to be phenomenally huge.
What about Austria? We've had a far-right presidential candidate who's Eurosceptic nearly win the elections.
Yeah, unlikely to win the recount. when we get to it. Again, I think Austria's. I don't know. I'm not sure that Austria is yet in that position. I think, you know, there might be some mileage in it for the FPÖ, but for them, I'm not sure. Again, I think it's hard to see how they can move, you know, go back to something that looks like a credible position outside the system, you know, kind of going back to the old EFTA model that they had. You know, and again, Austria's still a relatively new member, so the memory of the pre-95 era is still going to be there. I think what you'll see, though, is that Austria is just going to be carry on being a difficult partner in the EU. That they might make the calculation that the best thing to do is to keep on pushing for limits on free movements, and to limit their exposure in the Eurozone, and that it's better to try and do that on the inside rather than the outside. So again, you know, the FPÖ has not looked like it's really gone very hard on the referendum issue in what it's been doing. But yeah, clearly, as we move back round to parliamentary elections, then I think that's going to be a question that comes back. But, you know, the presidency is not a very substantive, you know, doesn't have a big number of substantial powers. So I think it's more, you know, it might be that, you know, Austrian voters are happy to let the FPÖ come in on those kind of positions, but still not ready for a governmental majority
Because the
on those kind of
president doesn't
things.
have power to hold a referendum.
No.
Okay. Austria has been affected by the migrant crisis. I don't know whether
Yeah.
that's because that's the reason for the shift to the right. Can we discuss a couple of other countries that have also been affected? Sweden.
Yeah, I think Sweden, well, Sweden's a bit like Finland as well. You know, I think the pair of them are, you know, the kind of, you've got, again, that Nordic skepticism about the system. But I think in the Swedish case, there hasn't really been, the far right haven't really made enough progress yet to really change the debate. And I think, again, you know, you've seen a pretty strong expression of liberal cosmopolitan values, that, you know, kind of the depth of engagement with the refugee crisis. You know, you haven't seen a str you've seen a bit of a backlash about taking in migrants from Syria, but nothing as bad as has been the case in other countries. So I think, you know, the Swedes look like they're a more reliable partner. Again, on the other side, as a non-Eurozone member, they are they've got more scope for pursuing those alternative models if they did choose to go and do that. But I don't get the sense that the Swedes are really heading down that route either. Finland's a bit different. I think that the Tree Finns look like they're making a lot more running, and I think they feel, you know, you get the sense that they're looking quite confident, although we've got a leadership challenge going on right now that might distract the party in the short run.
Okay. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there.
And I also wanted to look at Germany. I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it, that Germany would leave the EU, but
Well,
there is the
we've done
rise
we've
of
done, yeah, we've done a lot of unthinkable things in the last 6 to 7 weeks. So, but yeah, in Germany, I don't know. The AfD is very erratic. You know, it comes, it goes, it comes back again. Still, clearly has a lot of internal problems going on, but there's, you know, there's evidently a small constituency for the party's politics. But, you know, those politics are rather strange. You know, the AfD doesn't look like other parties. It's not populist in quite the same way as other countries have got. It's, you know, it's quite liberal in its economic agenda.
Right.
In terms of EU membership, I think that remains a largely, it's still not really a debatable topic in the German debate. I think, you know, there's a bit of it, but it's much more about other countries need to sort themselves out, and, you know, if they don't sort themselves out, they should go, rather than Germany doesn't need these other countries, you know, we can go it alone and do our own thing. So I think I can't see that changing anytime soon. But yeah, you know, Germany for a long time was always an outlier in sort of terms of Euroscepticism. They didn't really have any organized opposition going on, except on the far right fringes, who were always rather unhappy about the EU. But I think that the breadth and the depth of the consensus in Germany about EU membership, I think, remains solid. That I think partly that's about the historical memory of the Nazi periods, but I think it's also a reflection that, you know, Germany is in the middle of Europe. It hasn't got anywhere else to go, that its international engagement is driven primarily by trading, and, you know, it has a very good situation. So, you know, it benefits a lot from membership. It is as close to a leading country and a directing country as the EU has. So, you know, to paint the downsides is a very difficult task politically, and I think that's not going to change in the long run. And even with all the challenges that the Eurozone has had, and the deep unhappiness about suddenly becoming responsible for a pile of Greek mortgages, I think even that doesn't look to have unsettled that broad consensus. So I think even if the AfD is able to strengthen its position further, look more coherent and directed, I think we're still going to struggle to see this happening. There's also, and the referendum issue, particularly in Germany, is very fraught because the constitution doesn't allow it. So again, the memories of the Nazis' rise to power mean that I think in Germany, if you ever get to questions about membership, it will probably have to be through an electoral route. It'll have to be some, you know, the AfD having to secure a majority in the Bundestag, rather than going down that referendum path.
Fine. Okay. Is there any other countries you'd like to discuss? I was going to mention Poland and Hungary, but kind of thought you might say they rely too much on EU membership despite there
No,
being.
I was surprised we hadn't got to Poland or Hungary. I think in both those cases, yes, there's an economic benefit from being in, and not so much from the funding actually, but more from the free movement, that they do benefit from accessing labour markets in the Western member states. You know, someone like Orban is he's, you know, quite prepared to push the argument a long way, and you know, the same in Poland with Law and Justice at Kaczynski is, you know, I think the immaturity of party politics in these kinds of member states, where things do change radically from election to election, does give an incentive to kind of go for big, bold policies. And I think in both cases, you know, they've been happy to try and, you know, make somewhat scandalous claims and take quite radical positions. You know, I think the question is how much this is about rhetoric rather than about substance. That at the end of the day, both countries have in the end come round to the consensus position. But they also, I think, are aware that they can extract concessions from other countries. So in a way, I think that almost diffuses some of the questions about membership and about having a referendum on membership, because they say, you know, well, we're fighting hard for you in this system. I think in the Polish case, it's clearly a security issue that the anxiety about Russia is actually the predominant international marker. And so the EU, in that sense, is less important. You know, what really matters is NATO. So I think, you know, that does tend to make it easier for law and justice to say, you know, we're not happy with this and we're not happy with that. But I think at the end of the day, they don't look like they are yet at a point where they are going to push seriously for referendums. And it's hard to see how any party can outflank them in the political system, that you'd need to have another kind of big turnover in the system. And I'm not sure we're quite at that stage.
Okay. Any other countries you wanted to mention?
I guess you might think about Ireland. You know, if the UK leaves, Ireland is really in a horrible position. It's going to take almost as much of an economic hit as the UK in the coming years. It's economically, politically, geographically intertwined with the UK. Then it might be possible that if the UK looks like it's doing well, that there might be calls in the Republic for saying, we think there is, it's actually better for us. Yes, we lose access to European markets, but if we can, you know, normalise our situation with the UK, that's actually of bigger benefit. Again, I think the Northern Irish situation is going to be key in that. But you can imagine that Sinn Féin might say, here's actually something that we could do and change. You know, that would require a big sea change of Irish politics. But it might be that, depending on how the UK situation develops, that might change the equation fundamentally for Ireland.
Okay. I would have thought that the Irish nationalists would want to do the polar opposite to what the UK does, given the history.
Yes, but economically, that might not be as desirable as it used to be. You know, the advantage of, you know, remember that Ireland basically came along with the UK in the accession process back in the 70s because it was so closely linked, and that joining the EU was a way to establish its independence and its integrity as a sovereign state. So, you know, you have seen diversification away from the UK, but still the UK remains by far Ireland's largest trading partner. And if the UK looks like it can get a good deal, and that the Irish could get something similar, that then they might, you know, they might feel that changes it, and that they can still be independent and sovereign in the way that they've always wanted to be, but that economically it makes more sense to do that. I think that's a longer term process. It's certainly not anything that's discussed right now, but I think, you know, the EU looks at the moment like it's changing quite radically. I think we still need to see what the kind of the shakeout of the Brexit process is, because it's clear that you're going to see changes in the EU, and I think that's the kind of the underlying question is, does Brexit crystallize reform agendas in the EU that change what the EU looks like? You know, do we go back to the kinds of things that were agreed in David Cameron's new settlement back in March, and say, well, we'll do those anyway. And, you know, do we revisit the four freedoms? Do we revisit the free movement of labour for everyone? Because, you know, at the moment, it's not looking like there's an awful lot of big defenders of free movements outside of the Commission and the Parliament. Yeah. So it might be that actually the system changes in a way that again alters the complexion, and that might well diffuse a lot of the pressures for countries to
Cool.
leave. But I think again, until I think we get to the autumn and we get some sense of who's pushing for what, it's going to be hard to tell.
Is it too early then to know what reforms might be on the table and the likelihood of it happening?
I think still a bit too early. I think we've not really got past the initial shock and bluster. It's clear for all that was said about not having informal negotiations that informal negotiations are going on. You've got Theresa May going and visiting everyone she can. Clearly, people are talking to each other, and not least because nobody knows what anybody else wants. So even if it's just kind of fact finding, I think that's still very much going on. And the fact that nobody has come up with anything approaching a plan or a deal suggests that we are still very early in the process. And nobody, I can understand the British situation where nobody wanted to come up with a proposal at this stage, but the fact that nobody's doing that from France or from Germany at this point, I'm not seeing lots of ideas coming out of think tanks or the rest at this point suggests that nobody had really properly got this nailed down.
Do you have any views on what should be done in terms of reform to stop the contagion of Brexit?
Well, I think if you're interested in stopping contagion, then I think probably free movement's going to become the issue that's come back on the table. Who is prepared to who's prepared to raise this taboo subject? The interesting thing is, I think a lot of other member states have probably hidden behind the UK and said, well, we support free movement, but now the UK goes, they might say, well, actually, we do have some problems and things we want to do. So the departure of the UK from these discussions actually, I think, is going to be a key moment because it will give us a better sense of who is, what's more properly what different countries want, that their ability to hide their preferences is going to be much more limited. But I think it's going to depend a lot on who it comes from. I think you have to imagine that somewhere like Poland, I see various things that suggest that the law and justice would like to limit free movement and kind of reassert sort of intergovernmentalist positions. But because they're Poland and because they don't have a whole load of cachet left in the system, they're not going. They can't by themselves get very far. So they need some more credible allies to help them on their way, and those look a little bit in short supply at the moment.
One question I was going to ask you was, are we overstating the contagion of Brexit? Is it the media running away with itself and
No, I think it's legitimate to ask. The EU doesn't look to be in a good place at all at the moment, and hasn't done for several years. With the mixture of the Eurozone crisis and the refugee crisis and Brexit, just it really goes to the heart of what the system is. What's it for? What's the benefit of it? When if it can't do these basic things right, and countries want to leave, I think that's a legitimate point to ask. Well, is this the start of something bigger? At the same time, I think as our little tour has kind of highlighted, other countries are in different positions from the UK. The UK is a quite particular case, has a quite particular history, and a a very particular way of framing its debate. As we're seeing now here in the UK, if you try to balance out what different people say they want, then actually you end up probably with something that looks like where we are right now. So it's not, it's not necessarily, it's as much about the lack of understanding of what the EU does as anything else. So, there's always going to be a set of trade-offs. I think, but it's still not clear as well how far the European political elite, as far as it exists, is going to take this as a serious wake-up call to try and address those kinds of issues. So, there's nowhere that looks like it's on the verge of going down the same route, but you can certainly see the conditions coming together that might make it more likely.
What do you think the likelihood of seeing another referendum on EU membership, say, in the next 5 years?
Elsewhere in the EU, I don't know. 50-50 is probably about where I am. I wouldn't be surprised in the French case, and if it did happen, I would be certainly thinking that there's a good chance that that would be lost. It might be that you have another voters initiative in the Netherlands. Again, I'm not sure if that what that would whether that would work or not. I think it's going to depend very much on what happens in the next year, I think, with the UK. If that looks like a car crash of a negotiation and car crash for the British economy, then I think that the likelihood drops right down. If it looks like it can be sorted relatively painlessly, then I think there's going to be more and more chance of this happening somewhere else. And again, that's kind of the paradox of delaying Article 50, that if we delay it, then we might well end up being able to work out a convenient solution for both sides. And so actually Article 50 can be done formally very quickly because we've kind of got the broad outline already. So that might bring it back on the table as well. So there's a lot of different levels coming together, and the other issues are going to be general elections, basically. So the French, the Dutch, the German elections next year are all going to be critical points, and that's going to determine a lot how this plays out.
Okay, brilliant. That's all I wanted to ask you. Was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that's
Okay.
plenty.
Simon Usherwood from the University of Surrey, thanks very much for taking the time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.